attention this weekend. And make no mistake, the whole purpose of this is to give glory to God and to strengthen your faith. This isn't about me. This isn't even really about science, but about how the natural world and natural revelation points back to God. We've thoroughly established that fact Friday, three times yesterday. We'll just quickly touch on it now. In Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. We can see that there is a creator in nature, but that's not enough. We need to look at nature and see how it points back to revelation in God's Word, and God's Word confirms everything we see in nature. In verse 7, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. That's where our faith and hope and trust is, in God's Word. So for those of you who weren't here, we are examining different scientific evidence and interpretations related to macroevolution, showing how it has really been debunked and creation is the only alternative. So this morning we only have about 45 minutes. The previous lectures we had a couple of hours. So we're going to have to move very rapidly through this. So pay close attention because you might not see a slide more than a couple of seconds. So we're going to look at three more frauds that are still taught in public schools today and will still be taught in public schools tomorrow in the state of Missouri. We looked at four yesterday. And the focus of this lesson really is going to come down to what I think is a central theme today in evolution versus creation is the genetic level, the DNA, the code, the information of life that is somehow in every living cell. So what we'll learn in this lesson is Darwin's finches undergo only microevolution. Fruit flies undergo only microevolution. And vestigial organs aren't even vestigial. These are three examples that are used in textbooks and schools. We'll skip over some of this. This is a response by a 15-year-old evolutionist to a creationist. I put this up here to see, for you to see what young people are being taught and the conclusions they're coming to based on these atheistic worldviews. He says, you call your readers intelligent and then try to fool them by juxtaposing Bible beliefs with scientific proof and giving false information to brainwash them. Well, he's setting up what we know as a straw man fallacy. It's a logical fallacy where you build up a straw man and then tear it down. And we say, well, that's not us. We're not that straw man. We don't believe we're brainwashing people. He says, you ignore many scientific discoveries. Can you explain the mutation of microbes when they become resistant to types of treatment? Hopefully you can explain that after this weekend. What would you call that? That is microevolution. And besides that, it doesn't even make the bacteria more fit to survive in the environment. It makes it more fit to survive in you when someone gives you antibiotics, but it's not necessarily beneficial in a natural setting. How do you explain that the leading psychoanalysts are finding that homosexuality is a natural, not a choice? Why would God hate this if He made people this way? This is just stupid. Well, maybe God didn't make people this way. Maybe people are corrupt and fallen because they're giving into their passions and their lusts. By the way, I am 15 years old. You have no control over my generations. Your efforts are pointless. Science is what is true. This is a middle school student here. This is not the same one that wrote this. But he wears a shirt to school in protest of God once a week that says God is dead. So that's what we're facing. We looked yesterday. We showed that the Supreme Court has even ruled in a dissenting opinion that creation science is valid science. And so we're doing a model comparison. The Darwinian model says all animals, all life forms arose from a common ancestor, a single-celled organism. And the creation model says no, at the Cambrian layer, at the bottom of the sedimentary rock layers, we see that all the major bioplana or phyla of animals suddenly appear in the Cambrian explosion. So let's review. Animals can change or vary, evolve within their own. This type of change is known as, wow, you guys are good, microevolution or the special theory of evolution. This type of change is not to be confused with macroevolution. Neo-Darwinian evolution does not stand up to the rigor of the four-tiered scientific method. Therefore, it's not scientifically falsifiable, which really means testable. In order for neo-Darwinian evolution to occur, millions and millions of mutations must occur that are both persistent, structural, and beneficial. That's what we call the PBS principle. If someone ever says, well, this is a mutation that proves evolution, ask them, is it persistent? Does it continue on? Does it benefit the animal? And is it structural? Antibiotic resistance isn't structural. It's an internal genetic change that is not expressed phenotypically in the structure of the animal. So the first thing we're going to look at is Darwin's finches. Unfortunately, the Anglican Church in Charles Darwin's time decreed that all the species on earth were fixed. However you see a species, that must be how God created them, which is not true. God could have created in the beginning a kind that through microevolution could have changed into these different kinds. Notice in Genesis, the first chapter in verse 24, then God said, let the earth bring forth a living creature according to its species, right? No, species is a man-made term that we use to try to differentiate animals. But the Bible really says kind, and we know that's the word men, from which we get the study baraminology to try to decide what were the original kinds. Cattle and creeping thing and beast on the earth according to its kind, and it was so. So in 1832, Charles Darwin, after he graduated with his bachelor's degree in theology, went on the HMS Beagle on a trip around the world. He was the ship's naturalist. So he basically observed nature and drew pictures and recorded information. So off the coast of Costa Rica, in Ecuador, we see there are approximately 13 major islands in the Galapagos Islands. On these islands, there was a great diversity of finches. Even to this day, you can go there and see all the finches. Charles Darwin discovered about 13 species on the Galapagos Islands, and he came to the conclusion that all of these species must have had a common ancestor, which was this South American finch. And we have no problem with that, because this is just microevolution. Just because some have larger beaks and smaller beaks, that doesn't mean they're evolving or changing into anything else. A bird is a bird is a bird. Here are some of the drawings from Darwin's book on the origin of species. But notice, humans have different beak sizes, don't they? Does that mean we're evolving? Not at all. Some people have shorter beaks or wider beaks, more thin, fat and tall. What does that prove? It proves nothing but allelic variation or variation within the genes that we are already given. There is what is known as the Greek nose, the Roman nose, the Arminid nose, and the Cirrid nose. That's the same thing that's going on with the finches. No different. Now, this is a much greater difference. As we described yesterday, the Applehead Chihuahua and the Great Dane. Now, that is a huge difference. But everyone admits that's not even evolution. In fact, if you breed a wolf down to a Chihuahua, it's not evolution. What is it? It's devolution. You're losing genetic information. This is a genetic mutant, a degenerate animal that has lost important genes. It's what we called yesterday genetic shuffleboard or genetic checkers. You're just moving around what God has already put there. In order for macroevolution to occur, we say this many times, this is important if you want to write this down, you have to have new information added to the genome. You can't take the information that God has already put there and just select for different traits. That's the way God set it up. Darwinian evolution, neo-Darwinian evolution, needs new information. That's why they say they need mutations, which is what we'll look at later. Well, Darwin's finches are also irrelevant to evolution, because in the 1970s, Peter and Rosemary Grant, award-winning scientists, went back to the Galapagos Islands and studied these birds, and they found a number of interesting things. They found that these beak sizes aren't moving unidirectionally. That is, they're not continuing to get big in one direction and the other birds get smaller. They're oscillating. They're going back between big and small. Why? Because there's an edge to evolution. You remember the book we talked about yesterday, The Edge of Evolution? That cannot be crossed. There are boundaries that cannot be crossed. Yes, some of us may have big and smaller noses, but no one's going to grow a trunk like an elephant. Why? Because God has not put that genetic information into us. Secondly, no new genetic material in these finches. Third, natural selection and variation within a kind do not equal neo-Darwinian evolution. Fourth, a finch is a finch is a finch. You know, humans vary in many different aspects, don't they? We have many different color eyes, different color skin, different heights. And what this suggests is that our original ancestor, our progenitor, which we understand from the scripture, was a man named Adam and a woman named Eve, would have had to have all of these genetic qualities within them. That is, all this information would have had to have been contained within their genome. And over time, due to geographic isolation and inbreeding of tribes and peoples, some people lost certain genetic information. As we said yesterday, we're all filled with mutations today. And we're being bombarded by beta particles coming down from outer space. Cosmic particles are striking your DNA right now. And when your DNA can no longer repair itself properly, that often leads to cancer. Mutations are not good. Mutations are bad. They're harmful. Then we looked at Neanderthal yesterday. What does Neanderthal prove? Variation within a kind. Neanderthals were humans. We looked at the children. The only reason these people look like apes is because they look kind of disheveled. You know, a lot of people look disheveled today. What about the ridge brows? Charles Darwin had big ridge brows. What does that prove? Well, these were just humans. Genetic shuffleboard. Let me introduce you to the tallest man in the world and the shortest man in the world, Bao Zhixun and Hei Pingping, 7'9" versus 2'5". What if these two guys were buried somewhere in the sedimentary layers in 5,000 years from now, if God allows the world to exist that long? These two individuals are discovered. You can imagine some evolutionists inventing some kind of, do you remember what they called them last night when we were looking at them? Just so stories. Stephen Gould called them just those stories. You just make up a story. Well, this small guy must represent a small group of pygmy people. You know, these small race of humans or non-humans that we evolved from. And this guy was, you know, some giant group that, or also an ape-like ancestor. Well, you see there, Neanderthals would fit very well within the range of given anatomical features that we have today. So again, and we can't stress this enough, losing information when one animal changes to another is not only like moving around allelic variations within the genetic makeup that we're given, it's like taking checkers off the board. You're removing genetic material. All these animals are fixed within their groups, which cannot be changed. Next, we'll look at fruit fly evolution. So this is one we were taught when we were in school. When I was in the seventh grade, we bred fruit flies for different mutations. We could change their eyes and their wings, different parts of their body, their thorax. Here are some of the common mutations of fruit flies. They're very simple to work with, first of all, because they mutate very easily, number one. And number two, they produce another generation every 7 to 10 days. So you can do this over a course of a semester very easily. And these are still used in textbooks today in the state of Missouri to say, see, this is evolution. These flies are mutating. The favorite mutation to talk about is the four-winged fruit fly. There's actually two mutations, and when you combine them, it creates this four-winged fruit fly. And people say, see, there it is. That's evolution, a four-winged fruit fly. That's structural. Well, it is structural, but does it meet the other two qualifications for a mutation to be beneficial to Darwinian evolution? Is it persistent? Does it continue in the wild if you release that animal in the wild? No. Do you know why? But it can't fly and it can't breed. It can't pass on offspring. Second, is it beneficial? Does it benefit it in any way? No. And that's why it's not persistent either. Those are kind of overlapping terms in this case. So that proves nothing. But unfortunately, many children do not recognize these differences, so they're not even able to argue with their teachers or even understand the difference between beneficial mutations and lethal or detrimental mutations. Well, why else do mutations in the fruit flies or in any other animal not prove macroevolution? Well, here's some other reasons. Over 99% of mutations are harmful. I might need to revise that. They're harmful or neutral. They don't do anything. But of the less than 1% of non-lethal mutations, no PBS, persistent beneficial structural mutations, have ever been found. That's another one of those questions you should write down and ask your biology teacher. Do you know any persistent beneficial structural mutations? Do you know one? You remember we discussed, I just remember this, you remember we discussed Richard Dawkins the other night? He's the most outspoken, most famous evolutionist in the world right now. This question was posed to him, okay? Dr. Dawkins, can you provide one example of a beneficial mutation for Darwinian evolution? Do you want to see what he says? I think I've got the clip here. If I can find it somewhere. Yeah, this is it. So I'll put this mic up here and hopefully you can...
So somehow we ought to be able to look around the world today and look at our ancestors. We ought to be able to see the intermediates between both.
Okay. Can you give an example of a genetic mutation or an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the inflammation in the genome?
And listen to his response. Okay, so basically he has no response. Can you please just stop the tape? He goes on and does a bait and switch, as we talked about yesterday, the fallacy of, what fallacy is that? Reification, where he, or forget which one, but he basically changes the subject, totally changes the subject, and for the rest of this conversation does not discuss mutations. So that's what the most famous outspoken atheistic evolutionist in the world has to say. He couldn't provide one beneficial mutation. So, finally, number three, in 1995, the Nobel Prize was given to Drs. Nusslein Volhard on the left and Dr. Eric Weisskopf for saturation mutagenesis. What they did is they searched for every possible mutation in the fruit fly, and that's why it was called saturation, because they looked for anything that would become apparent based on mutations, and they didn't find one structurally beneficial mutation. Okay, they got the Nobel Prize because they were able to show all possible mutations. What does that tell you? Not only is evolution probably not possible, macroevolution, it's impossible. The fruit fly doesn't change into anything else. Now, in order for it to evolve, you'd have to have thousands of mutations, but they can't find one. I've often wondered what he's laughing about here when he's talking to this lady, and I like to imagine that she's saying something like, don't tell anyone that we didn't find any beneficial mutations in fruit flies. They still think fruit flies prove macroevolution. And teachers do. And this week, teachers are going to teach students that evolution is true because of fruit flies. And your taxpayer dollars are going to fund those teachers to teach those things. We'll skip the stretch break with the degenerate chihuahua there. Neo-Darwinists also cannot account for the accumulation of 30,000 human genes gradually coming to existence. If we evolved from apes, we have to have 30,000 genes. If you count it on a point mutation level, yesterday we looked at the base pairs, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, it would be 116 million point mutations or 30,000 new genes, which are discrete sections of DNA that code for a particular function of a protein. But they can't come up with even one mutation. And we would have to have 30,000 between us and the apes. What does that tell you? Finally, evolutionary scientists and philosophers even admit mutations have nothing to do with us evolving from microorganisms. They do not produce evolution. I'm going to give you 20 quotes from the evolutionists themselves that show that mutations cannot produce macroevolution. Why is this so important before we go into this? Well, what was the definition of Darwinian evolution that we've looked at about five times? Darwinian evolution is based on mutations and natural selection. That's why mutations are important. Well, what do the scientists have to say? We looked at Jeremy Rifkin yesterday. Notice what he says about the fruit fly. The fruit fly has been the favorite object of mutation experiments. X-rays have been used to increase the mutation rate by 15,000%. Scientists have been able to catalyze the fruit fly evolutionary process. Listen to this, the equivalent of millions of years of normal mutations in evolution. In other words, they speeded it up and produced many more mutations. Even with this tremendous speed up of mutations, and this guy isn't a creationist, he said scientists have never been able to come up with anything than another fruit fly. Not only that, they've never been able to improve on the fruit fly, to make a better fruit fly with all these mutations. Dr. S. Lovtrup from Umeå University in Sweden said the fruit fly, the favorite pet of the insect of geneticists, seems not to have changed since the remotest times. When we go down in the fossil column, we see fruit flies unchanged. They're indistinguishable from what we see today. Arthur Kessler says the educated public continues to believe Darwin provided the answers by the magic formula of random mutations. Mutations turned out to be irrelevant. And then I want to introduce you to this book that we talked about a little bit this weekend, but not in detail as much. I would recommend you get a copy of this and another one I have if you're interested in studying this issue. This is called the Altenburg 16. In 2009, the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, scientists got together and held what was supposed to be kind of a secret conference in Altenburg, Austria. 16 of the best minds, the greatest evolutionists around the world. The whole purpose of the conference was to say, Neo-Darwinism is dead. We've got to come up with a new idea. Because the public is starting to catch on that macroevolution by neo-Darwinism is not true. A lot of people have criticized Susan Mazur, who is actually a kind of an investigative journalist who wrote this book. But if you read through here, she wrote very little. This book is basically filled with just quotes from the 16 scientists that attended the conference. So she kind of broke the story, got it out in the open. It got in Science Magazine, the second most prestigious scientific journal. They began criticizing her and wrote up something derogatory about her. Eventually they apologized for it because everything she was saying is true. Neo-Darwinism is dead. I'll show you some quotes from this book. One of the most famous scientists is Lynn Margulis. And we mentioned yesterday she was a Darwin-Wallace medalist. That's given to evolutionists only once every 50 years. Other awardees were Peter and Rosemary Grant, who I showed you, Finch scientists, as well as Stephen Jay Gould. They all won this award in 2008. Notice what she says. I have seen no evidence whatsoever that these evolutionary changes can occur through the accumulation of gradual mutations. Neo-Darwinism, which insists on the slow accrual of mutations by gene-level natural selection, is a complete funk. It's dead. Darwin's claim of descent with modification as caused by natural selection is a linguistic fallacy. She says it never occurs. She says the notion is, and before we go on further, for those who weren't here, she is the ex-wife of the late Carl Sagan, and their son Dorian Sagan has written about 10 books with her. She's also, if any of you have taken biology, she's the one that came up with the idea that, and this is a little bit deeper, but the mitochondria within the human cell, the eukaryotic cell, actually used to be another bacteria or virus that got sucked up into the cell and became part of that organism. So our mitochondria is supposedly another organism living inside of us. That paper, I think, got rejected by 12 different journals before it got published. She says the notion is that if we accumulate enough gene change, enough mutations, we explain passage from one species to another. An entire tradition of devolutionary description was developed based on a conceptual topological error. It's basically just saying neo-Darwinism is wrong. She says the source of purposeful inherited novelty in evolution, the underlying reason that new species appear, is not random mutation. And yet that's what's taught in the public schools, that random mutation produces evolution. Okay, she's one of the top 10 cutting-edge evolutionists in the world. And she says that idea is wrong. She says variation mostly does not come from gradual accumulation of mutations. In fact, notice this. This is what they're saying in this book, too. A fine scientific literature on this theme exists and grows every day. In other words, she says, you can go into scientific journals and see, even the scientists admit it, but why don't we hear about it? She says it's neglected nearly entirely by what? The money powerful, the publicity mongers of science and the media. Follow the money trail. The evolution industry is big business. Now, she also spoke about Francisco Ayala, who got his PhD from Columbia University. She said at that meeting, this meeting here, Ayala agreed with me that neo-Darwinism is dead. Advances in molecular genetics, evolution, ecology, biochemistry led him to agree that neo-Darwinism is dead. The purpose of the conference was we've got to come up with a new idea. Here's another man who was at the conference, very famous scientist from University of Lund, Antonio Lima de Feria. He said the experimental results, remember we said the publications where the scientists even admit this, have been available for 35 years, but they've been ignored or silenced to avoid creating cracks in an edifice based on randomness and selection. In other words, we have to be careful. We can't give any of those creationists credence. Notice what Pierre-Paul Grasset says. The appearance of mutations permitting animals and plants to meet their needs seems hard to believe. Thousands of lucky events. It would require thousands of lucky events. Thus, miracles would become the rule. So what he's saying is, yes, mutations may cause evolution, but what would it take? It would take miracles. You see how evolution is based on faith and not really empirical science? This is Brian Charlesworth. I'm trying to see how we're doing on time here. He says, there is nothing in evolutionary biology that justifies assumptions that a successful mutation is always associated with some global measure or phenotype. He says, mutations with drastic phenotypic effects, and what that means is mutations that change the structure of the animal, that change the features. Is that good? In school you hear, mutations are good. Okay, here's the guy that knows. He says they are overwhelmingly likely to cause disorganization. So we have a loss of information. We have the wild type wolf losing information and going down to the degenerate poodle. We see the same thing in the fruit fly lab. Worse than gene shuffling, it's taking genes off the table. C.P. Martin was the chair of anatomy at McGill University. He said, the truth is, there is no clear evidence of the existence of helpful mutations. You wonder why Richard Dawkins was mute a minute ago and he couldn't think of any beneficial mutations? He said, endless millions, this is what macroevolution would require, endless millions of small and great genetic differences exist, but there is no evidence that they arose by mutation. In other words, there's millions of differences in all the animals in the world, but there's no evidence that they came about by mutations. Then how did they come about? Friends, I think this is the evidence we're talking about that points back to an intelligent designer, to a creator, that shows macroevolution could not be true. So I'll introduce you to a second book, What Darwin Got Wrong. We talked about Jerry Fedor yesterday. He is actually an atheist and does not care for creationists at all. But he wrote this book to say, we've got to come up with a new idea. He said, it's not out of the question that a scientific revolution, no less than a major revision of evolutionary theory, is in the offing. What he's saying is we've got to come up with a new idea. That's the empirical issue. And he says this is how neo-Darwinists respond, though. They say we can't do without biology, and biology can't do without Darwinism, so Darwinism must be true. That's faith. He says it's entirely possible that adaptationism, that's neo-Darwinism, is the wrong answer. And yet it's still taught in schools. And I'm putting this picture of this pig up here because this is from his article, Why Pigs Don't Have Wings. And that's kind of a play on words we can talk about later if you want. If, as I suggested, natural selection is flawed, alternatives would be welcome. What he's saying is you guys need to give us some new ideas. The classical Darwinist account of evolution is in trouble on both conceptual and empirical grounds. What he means is philosophically it's wrong, and when you go in the lab, the wet lab, to test it, it's also wrong. Darwin was seduced by the analogy to selective breeding. This analogy is flawed. Selective breeding, and we've got some people with beef cattle in here, selective breeding is performed only by minds. You see, you have to select for the characteristics you want very carefully. And natural selection doesn't have one of those minds. But Darwinists often argue that way. Well, how does evolution work? This is what he says. Darwinists say it works by the selection of traits produced by random variations in genes. That's essentially Darwin's hypothesis. I think not. There's something wrong with the theory. It goes deep. And just to back up, remember, Darwinism was discarded in the 1930s. I know I've probably said this four times. And it was replaced with neo-Darwinism, because they stole Gregor Mendel's idea of genetics. Gregor Mendel, who was a creationist and opposed Darwin, they stole his ideas and put it into Darwin's ideas, got rid of Darwinism. In the 1930s, they came up with neo-Darwinism. Now we're in a very critical time where neo-Darwinism is being questioned, even by the atheists and evolutionists, and they're about to discard neo-Darwinism whenever they can come up with a new evolutionary idea. This is quote number 19. Dr. N.H. Nielsen says, occurrence of mutations is by no means a proof of current evolution. It's absolutely impossible to build a current evolution on mutations or on recombinations. Kevin Padian said, does anyone still believe populations sit around for tens of thousands of years waiting for favorable mutations to occur? Let's see how many more slides we have left and how much time we have. We've got about 10 minutes. Let me just show you a cartoon. And I think after what we've talked about this weekend, you can answer this cartoon. I don't think it'll shake your faith. This cartoon is written by evolutionists to mock creationists. This is very common. It's what you're going to see when you go on university campuses. I don't know if you can read it, so I'll read it to you. So the scientists say, this bacteria seems to have mutated and become antibiotic resistant. Yes, it's a classic example of evolution through natural selection. People are very sick. We must learn more about the new strain. And then someone crashes through the door, you know, coincidentally looking a little bit like Jerry Falwell with a Bible. Who are you? I'm a member of the Creationist Patrol. And there's no such thing as evolution, you deluded Darwinist. Then how did this bacteria survive antibiotics? And he says, well, you need to look in the Bible. So how do we fight this deadly disease? There's a biblical solution to every answer. So later, this one guy says, I'm building a tiny ark, which I'll put all the bacteria on and send them away. And this other guy says, I'm building a bacteria tower. Well, they're all climbed to heaven. And then the preacher says, now we're getting somewhere. This is wrong on so many levels, it's hardly worth answering. But you could probably answer this in some ways. What does antibiotic resistance in bacteria prove? It proves variation within a kind. It's microevolution. But what they don't tell you is that whenever a bacterium becomes antibiotic resistant, it's actually less fit to survive in the wild. Because every time you change a gene, for another purpose, it actually has what they call a global effect. It affects other genes. So now this bacteria can no longer do some other functions in the wild. For that reason, we get in trouble when we modify our bacteria and make them antibiotic resistant in the lab, because the reviewers say, that doesn't represent what you see in the wild. Well, this is called an ad hominem attack, where they just attack the person and attack the man. And also, there is no creationist in the world that has a problem that I know of with antibiotic research. This is basically just very dishonest. It's clear bias on the part of evolutionists. The last thing we'll look at in 5 minutes is our vestigial organs. Before we go on to this, and this is pretty simple to deal with, are there any questions? We're in a class format here as the assembly is broken up and the children, other teachers are in their other classes. So does anyone have any questions at this point?
Why is it important that you go back to the wild on trying to figure out if something is going to survive?
Okay. Well, the idea is if something is mutated and you want to say it's better, it has evolved and it's better, what is it better for? You have to release it back into the wild, and it has to be able to outcompete the other animals, because Darwinian evolution is based on natural selection. So you have to put the animal back in nature, and nature selects, quote, selects for the strongest, and the weakest dies off. That's why we refer back to the wolf. You know, all these breeds of dogs, if we release them into the wild, 90% of them probably would die. 10% might start breeding and eventually interbreed with wolves. I don't know if that answers your question or if someone else has a addendum to that or clarification. Any other ideas or thoughts or questions?
Seems like
right. And I think that goes back to what we discussed the past couple of nights, where the humanists have really won the battle in the school systems, and they've come to the conclusion that we have to accept naturalism. We have to find naturalistic means to everything. God has to be out of the picture, and so we have to invent some idea of how things naturally occurred. And so that's why it's really inconsistent. And it's not empirical science. Empirical science means you have to be able to run an experiment and show by results, prove your hypothesis. Evolution is the other way around. It turns the whole scientific method on its head. It comes to the conclusion, and then later it goes to try to do experiments to support the conclusion it already believes in. So that's why we call it an a priori philosophy. The philosophy precedes the scientific experimentation. And you're saying, yes, the scientific experimentation should precede the conclusions. But it boils down to, it's a philosophy. And it's called humanism. We have to trust in our own minds and in nature, and God has to be put out of the picture.
Level on up, that's where
Yeah, so just to rephrase your question, what can you restate your question briefly? Sure. I think honestly that all depends on the school district you're in. There are certain school districts where the superintendents and the principals, if you even question evolution, they'll put you on administrative leave until you change your mind, or then they'll fire you. You have to get a lawyer. There's other school districts I know of in places where I know, and I wouldn't say where they're at since the camera's on and this may be distributed, that creationism is actually taught in public schools, and the principal knows about it and just turns a blind eye and lets the teachers teach it. So just it's based on where you're at, what you know you can get away with. But legally, according to the Supreme Court, if I was a biology teacher, this is what I would do. I would teach evolution and macroevolution. After each principle I taught, I would expose all the weaknesses. And I would use quotes like I'm using. I wouldn't quote from the creationists. I would quote from the evolutionists and show how they even admit it's wrong. Then there's nothing they could do. What are they going to sue the evolutionists for questioning evolution? That's what I would do. And the Supreme Court has ruled you can. You can expose all the weaknesses to macroevolution. It just depends on whether your principal is going to let you get away with it or not. Mm-hmm. Anything else? We'll do the vestigial organs really quick. This is really a dead argument, because all doctors, all physicians, and pretty much all PhD scientists know that vestigial organs can no longer be considered vestigial. The idea is, in our evolutionary past, we used to have these organs that were useful, but now they're not useful anymore, so they're just kind of disappearing. Let's say that's the truth. What if we do have organs that are disappearing? Based on what we've studied, does that prove evolution? What does it prove? Devolution. It proves that we're losing things. We're losing genetic information. If you want to prove macroevolution, you need to show us where a new organ is being created, where a new organ is growing, where we're growing a third eye in the back of our head so we can look around back. You know, maybe that might be considered evolution. So some of them are tonsils, appendix, coccyx, tailbone. Did you know in 1931 a German scientist wrote a book that listed 180 useless vestigial organs? But today, every single one of these organs have been shown to have a purpose in the human body. It cannot be proven that an organ has no use. Even if it could, it would prove devolution. Physicians and scientists admit to this, even evolutionists. In 1981, this guy said vestigial organs provide no evidence for evolutionary theory, but it's still taught in schools. G. McCarty in the journal Gastroenterology in 1976. Okay, what is this? Almost 40 years ago? He said the appendix is not generally credited with significant function. However, current evidence tends to involve it in the immunologic mechanism. The appendix is an immunologic organ. Then why can we take it out and we're fine? Well, what I've seen in the scientific literature, the best evidence now shows it is extremely important in the development of the immune system of infants. And when you grow up, you may not need it anymore, but you do need it as an infant. In 1992, Dr. K.L. Moore said, the appendix is a well-developed lymphoid organ. If so, why do our kids continually be taught, or continually being taught in school, that it's useless? Even Wikipedia now says the tonsils are used to help fight off upper respiratory infections. This is basically a teacher saying, see the tailbone? That used to be a tail, but it has devolved. And the student says, sir, there are 9 muscles attached to that tailbone. You know what would happen if you didn't have a tailbone? You would not have those 9 muscles that go underneath the pelvis. And looking at an anatomical standpoint for females, or for men with bladder, your bladder and your uterus would fall right down. It would not be supported. And yet I was taught in school, oh, see your tailbone? That's just from the monkey that you used to be. Hair on human skin, that's useful. The wings of flightless birds, they're useful. I can think of 4 reasons very easily. Hip bones in whales. oh, you see these hip bones? These are when whales used to walk on land, then they evolved back into the ocean, now they're losing these. Well, it's been shown these bones are actually used during breeding, when these animals mate. They're useful. They're not used for walking on land in their past. And then there was a book written called Vestigial Organs Are Fully Functional, and it lists all 131 of those organs and shows that they are useful. Now, if this is the case, then why are our students still being taught this in schools with your taxpayer dollars? Now, do we conclude at quarter till? Okay, we'll wrap it up then. And I'll conclude with this comment we used before. Henry Lipson, head of physics at University of Manchester, said evolution became a scientific religion. Scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to, and this answers your question, prepared to bend their observations to fit with it, because it's a religion. It's a philosophy. Consequently, we should not be surprised. Peter even said, with regard to theology, but I think this applies to philosophy, there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction, and many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. Friends, we shouldn't be surprised. That should just make us put more faith in God and less faith in man. Thanks again for your attention.